We'd like to welcome everyone here today. Glad you've showed up for this. Mike will be presenting a paper, Changing Revelatory Messages, a Mormon Example. Let me introduce Mike. Mike Marquardt is an independent historian and a research consultant. He was doing Mormon history long before it was cool to do Mormon history. For decades, he has continually contributed to the body of Mormon scholarship. To get an idea of how much research Mike has done, consider the size of his collection here on this campus at the J. Willard Marriott Library. It consists of 419 boxes with over 4,000 items. So if you've got a little spare time, you can read through Mike's collection here on campus. Mike is generous in sharing his expertise with other historians. He's on the editorial staff of the Journal of Mormon History and on the editorial board of the John Whitmer Historical Society. He's written a number of books. A couple of them include Early Patriarchal Blessings of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the Joseph Smith Papers Revelations, Text and Commentary.
Divine revelation is usually thought as imparting the truth to men and women by deity. How this wisdom has been communicated between heaven and earth and how it is different from ordinary human thought remains a mystery. For Joseph Smith, revelation seems to come from day-to-day experience, from interactions with other people, and from the study of biblical texts. Richard Van Wagner explained, upgrading of revelation and retrospective editing the past are hallmarks of early Mormonism. On December 31, 1833, 29-year-old Wilford Woodruff was baptized into the Church of Christ. In August 1834, a copy of the Book of Commandments was purchased from him from John Whitmer.
Excuse me,
Antoine,
could you speak up? I'm like sitting underneath the air conditioning vent here. Ezra, could you speak up the
daughter? There's no microphone, so if you have no rubs in, maybe come up closer.
Wilford Woodruff recalled two decades later, I saw the Book of Commandments or Revelations given through Joseph Smith, and I believed them with all my heart and rejoiced therein. A few smaller organizations, such as the Church of Christ Temple Lot and Churches of Christ with the Elijah Message, used the Book of Commandments for part of the restoration story. On April 6, 1830, at Manchester, New York, a revelation regarding Joseph Smith, Jr. and the Church of Christ declared, Wherefore, meaning the Church, thou shalt give heed unto all his words and commandments, which he shall give unto him, as he receiveth them, walking in all holiness before me. By comparing early texts, one can often reconstruct the original wording. Revelations did not have to be revised, but by examining the messages that were changed, we get an insight into why these revisions were made. Joseph Smith revised the revelations in accordance with his developing theology. God's word relayed through fallible prophets was neither inerrant nor static in Smith's view. So as the need arises, he revised the Bible, the Book of Mormon, his autobiography, and his revelations. That Joseph Smith in general made changes in the written revelations can only tell us one thing, that he did not believe the particular words he put down on the page were literally God's. The changes made in many of the 1828 to 1833 revelations reflect Smith's theology. Modifications in church government, recognitions of former discrepancies and sensitivity to criticism engendered by the originals as reconstructed in early 1835. The modified wording represents things that occurred not at the time of the revelations, but at a later time. These clear-cut redactions indicate ideas out of their proper time frame and are known as anachronisms. In 2009, a handwritten manuscript book titled A Book of Commandments and Revelations, hereafter cited as BCR, which had been in the possession of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints since the 1830s, was published by the Church Historians Press. The record contains handwritten modifications to the prophet's revelatory messages. This is the earliest known compilation of Smith's revelations or commandments. Richard L. Bushman explained, he revised his own revelations, adding new material and splicing one to another, altering the words as he saw fit. He felt authorized to expand the revelations as his understanding expanded. Through textual criticisms, individuals and scholars determined what the early wording of the text contained. This textual evaluation confirms that revelatory documents have been modified after their reception. Just like scholars who compare biblical texts, the same method can be used in comparing handwritten manuscripts and printed works to arrive at the early text. Historical research indicates that this is correct and leaves it to theologians to evaluate what it means to the various concepts of revelation in the Latter-day Saint community. Individuals involved in printing of Smith's revelations included Oliver Cowdery and William W. Phelps. Their handwritten notations are contained in the BCR, and Oliver Cowdery worked on the printing of the Book of Commandments and the Evening and the Morning Star. Cowdery's copy of the Book of Commandments contained notations for the new edition of the Revelations for the forthcoming work, Doctrine and Covenants of the Church of the Latter-day Saints. Many of the revisions by Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery occurred during the months of January through June 1835. A reprint of the Star contained the revised text for a few revelations that were used for the Doctrine and Covenants. They did not possess the BCR until the arrival from Missouri of John Whitmer and W.W. Phelps on May 16th. In preparing the revelatory messages for the new publication, Smith wanted to include in this work a better image of his organization. By this means, he could provide new understanding to his messages. Looking backward to prior revelations, he gave new interpretations with clear understanding to the church he founded. The book contained the doctrine as presented in a series of lectures on the theology of faith authored by Sidney Rigdon, who was the church's theologian. The second part of the Doctrine and Covenants was the Covenants and Commandments. As the preface explained, it contained items or principles for the regulation of the church. This helps explain why the locations where many of the revelations were received were omitted and only a month and year included. The church's change in situation is reflected in the alterations of the revelations. Knowing the historical background of the revelations makes it easy to understand why Smith wanted to alter the original rendering to a new situation. Most of the revelations were given during the primitive period of the church's development. This later altered form helps us understand the doctrinal, historical, and theological shifts. Oliver Cowdery was blessed in April 1834 to assist Brother Sidney Rigdon in arranging the church covenants. In September, Cowdery was selected to join Joseph Smith, Frederick J. Williams, and Sidney Rigdon to form a committee to arrange the items of doctrine and revelations for the church. previous to the BCR publication, one could determine that there would be some textual revision to LDS Doctrine and Covenants section 17, 51, and 57, since they were not published in the Book of Commandments. LDS section 17 states that there would be three witnesses to the Book of Mormon who would see the plates by faith. The text was modified by adding the biblical term Urim and Thummim, which was not in use in 1829. LDS section 51 mentioned that the church bishop Edward Partridge was to receive consecrated properties. The opening part of the text was not included, but this could be an oversight. But there were added words containing a post-1831 concept. LDS section 57 has a note, not to be printed at present. This is the revelation that designated Independence, Jackson County, Missouri, as the center place for the New Jerusalem and its temple. The redactions made in this revelatory message are not consistent with the prospect of bringing the gospel to the Native Americans. The original wording contained instructions on taking the gospel to the Lamanites. Let my servant Sidney Gilbert obtain a license. Behold, here is wisdom, and whoso readeth, let him understand, that he may send goods unto the Lamanites, even as whom he will, as clerk employed in his service, and thus the gospel may be preached unto them. The 1835 revision reads in part, let my servant Sidney Gilbert obtain license, that he may send goods also unto the people, even as whom he will, as clerks employed in his service, and thus provide for my saints, that my gospel may be preached unto those who sit in darkness and in the region and shadow of death. The thrust of the passage was altered. First, all the goods were now to be sent to the people, which obscures the meaning. Second, the people are more specifically designated as being the saints. And third, the purpose was to provide means for preaching to the lost anywhere. The following are some examples in numerical order from sections of the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants. Section 1. The source is Oliver Cowdery's Book of Commandments. Section 2. By January 1835, there were references to offices instituted after their acceptance at the conference held in June 1830. Included in the revision were bishops, high counselors, high priests, and president of the high priesthood. The 1835 office of apostle was not added. Section 3. How much of Section 3 was presented in its 1835 form to the 12 apostles is not known. The citation to a revelation given on November 11, 1831 illustrates how textual redactions of 1835 could give the impression that the wording used in the original 1831 revelations, how that revelation text contained. The earliest text says a bishop must be chosen from the high priesthood, meaning from those who hold the office of high priest. The idea of a bishop being a descendant of Aaron was also repeated in section 22, which is another November 1831 revelatory message. Section 4. The early text said that John the Baptist was to be raised up filled with the Holy Ghost from his mother's womb. For he was baptized while he was yet in the womb. For this section, the words the womb were omitted and replaced with his childhood. Section 5. The minutes of the February 17, 1834 meeting of the Kirkland High Council were read at least twice 2 days later. Joseph Smith was authorized to make corrections at the time. The minutes were corrected and recorded in the Kirkland Revelations book. 8 months later, after April 28, 1835, a reference was added to the minutes about a distinction between the High Council of Traveling High Priests abroad and the Traveling High Council composed of the 12 Apostles. Section 13. This section is a revision of instructions given 4 years previously. When this section was reprinted in February 1835, changes were made to the law of consecration. The words High Council, not in the Revelation of 1831, were added. Words relating to Joseph Smith's Bible revision were again modified, and the office of high priest inserted. Section 22. The 1831 text stated that other bishops could be set apart, and they would need to be a high priest who is worthy and be appointed by a conference of high priests. The conference is changed to being appointed by the first presidency of the Melchizedek priesthood, except to be literal descendants of Aaron. A descendant of Aaron would have the legal right to the bishopric. In this edition, there were further clarifications than what is found in Section 3. Again, the incorrect impression is that this is the identical revelation given on November 1, 1831 to Orson Hyde, Luke Johnson, Lyman Johnson, and William McClellan. The early wording gave the instructions, "These sayings are true and faithful, wherefore transgress them not, neither take therefrom." In the revisions, words like conference and high priest were omitted and replaced. The reason why these words were changed is because since March 1832, there was a new council known as the Presidency of the High Priesthood and designated in 1835 as the first presidency, usually composed of three high priests. This redaction was done after May 16th and near the end of June 1835, when the printing of the reprint of the Evening and Morning Star. Section 24. Another revelation of interest is a prayer that was revealed and copied in the BCR, Kirkland Revelation Book, and printed with the same wording in Independence, Missouri in 1832 and in Kirkland, Ohio in 1835. The BCR contains the minor change which helps us to determine the words crossed through, hewn from, and replaced with cut out of would have been done shortly after May 16th in time to set the type for the Doctrine and Covenants. Section 50. The shortest text supports the basic wording that was printed in the Book of Commandments. Of all the revisions, this one was very important since the organization of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles was completed at the end of April 1835. The names of those who would partake of the fruit of the vine with Jesus were added to the early text. The 1835 revision lists Moroni, Elias, John the Baptist, Elijah, and other patriarchs. Also mentions were Michael or Adam, Peter, James, and John. The New Testament apostles Peter, James, and John, who held the keys of your ministry, now first appear in a church record. Although there is no known account of Peter, James, and John being sent to Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery, the names of the three apostles were added to the 1830 revelatory message after May 16, 1835. The redaction makes sense since in advancing the idea of priesthood keys, Moroni holds the keys of the record of the stick of Ephraim and others having their keys committed to men on the earth. Each key would help in the restoration of all things. The 1835 printed text is not the message presented by an angel in the voice of Jesus given in September 1830. No church member is known to worry that this revelation represented a new tradition and changed an earlier message in the light of new understanding since the church had its own quorum of 12 apostles. Book of Commandments chapter 28 was greatly expanded when it was printed in the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants. The material added to the 1835 version included updated and expanded doctrine on priesthood keys that was not known at the time the revelation was originally dictated. Section 75. This revelation given in Kirkland, Ohio on March 1, 1830 included pseudonyms. So the heading for the 1835 DNC said, "The order given of the Lord to Enoch for the purpose of establishing the poor." While this is not a revelation given to ancient Enoch, it gave the impression in the heading that it was. The words Jesus Christ were changed to the Son Amen. The largest insertion mentioned the Lord God, who hath established the foundations of Adam on Diamond, who hath appointed Michael your prince, and established his feet, and set him on high, and given to him the keys of salvation, under the counsel and direction of the Holy One, who was at beginning of days or end of life. It is possible that this edition was on a pin note in the BCR. This edition is of interest regarding the place of Adam in Latter-day Saint theology. The above historical examples help establish the original text, shows us how changes were made to those revelations. The textual history of the revelations as a living document give them changing, show them changing and growing. Every stage in the development provides us with valuable insights. However, the earliest texts are essential in uncovering the original intentions and meanings of the revelations and the historical circumstances surrounding them. A better text leads to a better appreciation of the early history of the Restoration Movement. Besides revising his commandments and revelations, Joseph Smith also revised the Bible in the first edition of the Book of Mormon. It should not come as any surprise that Smith revised the early story of his visionary experiences. This is evident in the accounts of a number of persons who heard him tell about his early life. At times, events were modified, omitted, and expanded. There are basically four church accounts that come from Joseph Smith. First, the 1832 account written by Frederick G. Williams and Joseph Smith. Second, Oliver Cowdery's 1834-35 letters containing information that came from Smith. Third, an 1835 account recorded in Joseph Smith's journal. And fourth, the manuscript history of Joseph Smith, commenced in 1838 and copied in 1839 and also considered Smith's journal. Joseph Smith told in his 1838-39 history about an excitement on the subject of religion, a revival, taking place before his first vision. He placed it in the spring of 1820. He said that he was told that all churches were an abomination. Members of his family joined the Presbyterian Church because of this religious excitement, while he was drawn to the Methodist. Later, an angel appeared to him and gave him instructions, and he said he eventually recovered a religious and historical record which was written on plates of gold. Like the revelatory messages that were changed, the early story was revised. The first published history of early Mormonism was written by Oliver Cowdery and printed in the Latter-day Saints Messenger and Advocate. This consists of a series of eight letters to W.W. Phelps. The third letter explains what occurred in the 15th year of Joseph Smith's life in 1820. One Mr. Lane, a presiding elder of the Methodist Church, visited Palmyra and vicinity. Elder Lane was a talented man, possessing a good share of literary endowments and apparent humility. There was a great awakening or excitement raised on the subject of religion and much inquiry for the words of life. Large additions were made to the Methodist, Presbyterian, and Baptist churches. Cowdery continued, "In this general strife for followers, his mother, one sister, and two of his natural brothers were persuaded to unite with the Presbyterians." In his fourth letter, Oliver Cowdery says there was an error in the type and corrects the date to Smith's 17th year when he says this would bring it down to the year 1823. Peter Crawley wrote, whatever was intended in letter 3, certain problems persist. Joseph Smith's 17th year was 1822, not 1823, and Reverend George Lane was most prominently in the Palmyra area in 1824 to 25. It is conceivable that Cowdery shifted the date after realizing he had introduced Lane at the wrong time. In Lucy Mack Smith's draft of her history, she adds details which also suggests an 1824 date for the revival. She begins by linking the revival to the death of her son, Alvin, who died in November 1823, which was subsequently crossed out. About this time, there was a great revival in religion, and the whole neighborhood was very much aroused to this subject, and we among the rest flocked to the meeting house. An examination of newspaper accounts, religious periodicals, church records, and personal narratives shows that there was no significant gains in church membership or any other sign of excitement or revival in Palmyra in 1820. There was a stirring and momentous revival there with all the features that Joseph Smith's history mentions during the fall and winter of 1824-25. At the beginning of his manuscript history, Joseph Smith stated, in this history I will present the various events in relation to the Church in truth and righteousness as they have transpired or as they at present exist, now being the 8th year since the organization of said church. The Palmyra excitement or revival is the backdrop for Joseph Smith's first vision. This history is a theological or faith account telling the events as they have transpired or as they at present exist. David Thien wrote concerning memory, what is important is that the memory be authentic for the person at the moment of construction, and not that it be an accurate depiction of past event a moment. Another historian, Marvin S. Hill, concluded that the 1838-39 account was streamlined for publication, making the story more logical and compelling. In the account written by Smith in 1832, a revival was not the motivating factor for the first vision, and he claims to receive the forgiveness of sins. Likewise, in his 1835 telling, he mentions a personage told him, thy sins are forgiven thee. Once it is realized that the revival and the first vision are two separate events, we begin to get closer to the personal experience of Joseph Smith in his religious quest. How much of Smith's 1838-39 account recalls his feeling near the time of this vision is hard to determine. But when other events are taken into consideration, it appears that the word abomination in reference to the creeds is language too strong, especially since members of the Smith family joined the local Palmyra Presbyterian Church after 1820. When it comes to Smith's second vision about an angel revealing to him the location of the gold plates and including the words spoken by this messenger, it is clear that the words are post-1823. Using Smith's story as a guide, we can see more clearly that the words in his history fit 1838 rather than pre-1827. The reason for this is that in 1836, Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery reported a vision of the Old Testament prophet Elijah. The messenger quoted the following text from Malachi chapter 4, verse 5. Behold, I will reveal unto you the priesthood by the hand of Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. Is it correct that the persons would have spoken these words in 1823? If these words were not spoken in the vision, then their absence would confirm that we were dealing with a theological story. It means that those actual words were not spoken during the visionary experience. It is a story of faith to those who embrace it. A simple examination makes it clear that the angel would not have spoken these words in 1823, but at a time beyond the publication of the Book of Mormon. There would be no reason to quote the passage differently. Sidney Rigdon, in 1830, was looked upon by a preparer, like John the Baptist, to prepare the way before Elijah, which should come. When one of the early commandments received on September 4th, 1830, was prepared for the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants, wording was added relating to biblical individuals who would drink wine with the returning Savior, and indicating the Elijah held priesthood keys with the words, "And also Elijah, unto whom I have committed the keys of the power of turning the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the hearts of the children to the fathers, that the whole earth may not be smitten with a curse." On April 3rd, 1836, it is recorded that Elijah the prophet appeared in a glorious vision to Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery and committed to them the keys of this dispensation. Looking back to 1836, Smith explained that the promise of Elijah coming to reveal Keith priesthood keys was a fulfillment of a promise made in connection to the time he first learned about the Book of Mormon plates. The added words related to the future promise of obtaining the priesthood by the hand of Elijah, and they are an anachronism. Joseph Smith perceived his 1823 experience as an important indicator of his prophetic role. As he retold the story to family, acquaintances, and eventually to church members, the initial experience took on special characteristics. In Smith's longest account, he states that in September 1823, a vision was opened to his mind and he saw where gold plates were deposited. He removed them from the ground 4 years later, in September 1827. One of the earliest persons who heard the story from Joseph Jr. was Joseph Knight Sr., a resident of Colville, New York. Knight, for whom Smith worked briefly in 1825-26, recounted elements of the early story as related to him in the fall of 1826. Joseph Smith, while at the hill, was told by the persons, "You should have took the book and gone right away. You can't have it now." Joseph says, "When can I have it?" The answer was, "The 22nd day next, if you bring the right person with you." Joseph says, "Who is the right person?" The answer was, "Your oldest brother." Joseph Smith's mother, Lucy, added her own recollections about the gold record in her memoir. She dates Joseph's first vision to the nearby hill as just before Alvin's death, who died in November 1823, and emphasized Alvin's place in these events. In the excitement of the moment, he laid the record down in order to cover up the box, lest someone should come along and take away whatever else might be deposited there. When he turned again to take up the record, it was gone. But where, he knew not, nor did he know by what means it was taken. Mother Smith remembered Alvin was especially interested in the record. On his deathbed, he told Joseph, "I want you to be a good boy and do everything that lies in your power to obtain the records. Be faithful in receiving instructions and keeping every commandment that is given you." In his redaction, Joseph Smith omitted laying the record on the ground. "I made an attempt to take them out, but was forbidden by the messenger." He also did not mention being told on that occasion to bring Alvin with him next time to the hill. 6 years earlier, in 1832, Smith said he attempted but did not remove the plates, as he straightway made three attempts to get them. The early story told by his mother, Lucy, friend Joseph Knight Sr., indicates that Joseph Smith said he removed the record and laid it down. Another element, as recorded by Joseph Knight Sr., was when Joseph finally asked when he could have the book and was told again to bring the right person. Joseph says, "Who is the right person?" The answer was, you will know. Then he looked in his glass and found it was Emma Hale. According to Lucy Smith's narrative, on September 20th, 1827, Joseph Knight Sr. and friend Josiah Stoll arrived at the Smith family frame house. Knight heard that Joseph was to get the record on September 22nd. On the morning of the 22nd, Joseph and Emma left the Smith home, taking Mr. Knight's horse and wagon without his knowledge to travel to the hill about 2 miles away. When they arrived at the hill, Joseph left Emma with the wagon while he went to the side of the hill. Joseph said he took the plates out of the box in the ground and hid them in a fallen treetop, concealing them with the bark of the tree. He returned to Knight's wagon, where Emma was waiting, and they started back to the house. The plates were now, according to Joseph, hidden in a fallen treetop, but a better place was needed to deposit them. According to Lucy, Joseph asked my advice what it was best to do about getting a chest made. They decided to have one made, but lacked the money for it. It was 9 days later when Joseph walked by himself to where he said he hid the gold plates. Several people remember the story they heard about how he brought the plates back to the Smith home. According to Lucy's version, Joseph took the plates from their hiding place, wrapped them in his linen frock, put them under his arm, and started for the house. He concluded it would be safer to go across the woods. He had not proceeded far in this direction till, as he was jumping over a log, a man sprang up and gave him a heavy blow with a gun. Joseph leveled him to the ground. Smith claimed he knocked down several men as he ran home, arriving out of breath. When all the commotion settled, Joseph showed those present his dislocated thumb, which his father put back in place. After this, Joseph went to Willard Chase's house and talked with him. Chase recalled the story that Smith told him, which is similar to the accounts of Mother Smith and Joseph Knight. On his return home, he said he was attacked by two men in the woods and knocked them both down and made his escape, arrived safe, and secured his treasure. He then acknowledged, if it had not been for that stone, which he acknowledged belonged to me, he would not have obtained the book. This interesting story was not included in any of Smith's accounts. Whatever was under his work smock or in the chest was concealed. Other members of the Smith family did not see a physical object, and none of the scribes indicate that Joseph Smith used the gold plates during the dictation of the Book of Mormon. How necessary the gold plate story was to the process of writing the Book of Mormon is a valid question for further study. A recent author, Brant A. Gardner, stated that the translation process did not include the physical examination of the plates as part of the translation. Over time, Joseph Smith omitted certain elements, expanded the words said to have been told to him, which changed the story from how it was first told. From his visionary instructions, originally told in a treasure-seeking context, Smith transformed his initial story into a religious saga with an angel guiding him into prophetic ministry. Since the early days of the Restoration, it was important to know that Joseph Smith was a prophet. His story was that important. A great way to understand how a story can change is to know that the Smith family was considered visionary. That is, that through the eyes of their understanding, or by second sight, they perceive hidden treasures under the ground, in mountains, in caves. This perception was a mindset in their treasure-seeking project and also in their religious seeking. It was while the Book of Mormon was being printed that Solomon Chamberlain visited a member of the Smith family. He recounts his first contact with them. I soon arrived at the house and found Hiram Smith walking the floor. As I entered the room, I said, "Peace to this house." He looked at me and said, "I hope it will be peace." I then said, "Is there anyone here that believes in visions and revelations?" He said, "Yes, we are a visionary house." In Joseph Smith's history, he left out using a stone in locating buried treasure, in finding the gold plates, in interpreting Egyptian writing, or in receiving revelatory messages. He added in 1838-39 that he was using the Urim and Thummim in translating and also in receiving revelations for his followers. Smith, like other individuals, developed in his ideas. Smith's recollection of events in his early life took on a more of a theological nature than historical reality, and his story grew in the telling. The words that he said that the angel spoke to him in 1823 about Elijah became of important significance as he looked back to his early life. It was not an issue to him that some of his ideas changed or contradicted what he had said earlier at an earlier time. Joseph was able to express his interpretation of events as he perceived new ideas in a revelatory manner. As an oracle to his fathers, Joseph's theological development became the Word of God. As Joseph Smith developed his thought, he provided new meaning and understanding to church members in his role as prophet and seer. These two Mormon examples on revelatory messages and storytelling usually have no impact when considered with a final official text. Critical studies usually do not play a part in what a believer has experienced. What is important is the story that is told within the context of faith. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. That was very interesting. We don't have a respondent, but we have a little extra time for questions and answers. Mike, maybe you could summarize the question for the recorder. Even though we don't have a microphone, there is a recorder here. So let me ask. Levina White, go ahead. What question do you have? Go ahead.
Mike, were you able to determine with any kind of specificity what the response of the Mormon people were to these various changes in the revelations? Did they notice? Did they care? Did anybody feel concerned except for Ezra Booth?
Well, yeah, Ezra Booth, he wrote in 1831, and he didn't go too much into changes, revelatory messages, because they were not published. But he did mention, for example, Revelation number 27 to Emma Smith. And he also indicated in section 17, LDS section 17.
What did he say about it?
Well, 17 was the one for the three witnesses. Now that, even though it would be in the BCR, it was not published in the Book of Commandments, but that said that the witnesses would see the plates by faith. There's not too much mention except that Oliver Cowdery, who was involved in with Joseph Smith in changing the revelations, indicates in the Evening and Morning Star reprint that some members may be surprised at the difference between the text that they were now printing and the earlier one in the Evening and Morning Star. And it wasn't until 1838 when we have Apostle Lyman Johnson and John Boynton and others. In fact, Warren Parrish mentions the change in some of the texts of the Revelation. But on the whole, there was not too much mention at all, mainly because the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants was so like what we would call the First Church Handbook of Instructions. Most of the revelations, they did not have the day of the month, and majority did not have the location, so it was just like a manual. Some parts were chronological, other parts were not. And so most of the people just didn't know that there were changes in the text of the revelations. Yes, Mark?
Mike, you just mentioned that revelations are not chronological, although in some cases there does have... Can you explain why when those revelations were put together, what the rationale was to juxtapose some as opposed to others? I mean, why is it that, I guess maybe I'm trying to be too logical here, but what are your thoughts about why the revelations are not placed one way?
Okay, the question from Mark Shearer was basically, why are some of the revelations not chronological? Well, when we look at the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants, the first section is, of course, the first chapter was going to be in the Book of Commandments. And after that would be the Articles and Covenants that were revised in the reprint that was published in January 1835. And remember, they're setting the type in Kirkland. They've already set the type for the lectures on theology by Sidney Rigdon. And so what we find is that the Section 3, which is LDS Section 107 on the priesthood, which is basically a talk that explains the priesthood, and that would have been changed by April 28th. So that dates to 1835. So we have 1831, 1830, 1835. Then we have Section 84, which is 1832, and they changed that. And then finally we got Section 5, which is the minutes of the High Council.
Why?
And so we know by William Phelps's letter of May 26, 1835, where he mentions that they've already printed up to 96 pages by May 26. And now, since they have the BCR manuscript with them, you will see changes made for the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants. And so some of those changes were made so they could set the type. Also, there were changes in the Kirkland Revelation book, so you have those. Plus, you have changes in Oliver Cowdery's Book of Commandments. And that copy of the Book of Commandments is in the Church History Library here in Salt Lake City. And so you actually know when things are being changed. And so, for example, Section 107, which in the current Doctrine and Covenants is dated in March of 1835, we know that was not in March, it was in April 1835. And so we can follow some of that. I followed some of it myself. We do have, by June of 1835, Section 68, which was changes reflected in the Book of Commandments and Revelations. Yes.
I get lost in all the exact things, but I think this is a wonderful opportunity for those who are still participating in the Council of the Brethren Church to come to an understanding of each other. As one who's left, my concern is not so much with which date has been, it's more the big things. But yesterday they gave a presentation about the different accounts in the first edition. I had a chance at all this morning to ask the gentleman who teaches Mormon studies at Berkeley. Yeah, but I understand that memories are fallible. We're humans. I've forgotten many things. And I remember some other detail later. I'm not concerned about that. What I'm concerned about is that the other people who were in the vision were taught about it, which was Jesus Christ. So on such a significant issue as God the Father,